40 Miler is the last full length I released, and I guess it's over a year old now. I actually just reissued my first demos from that I recorded in like 2003 and 2004 that actually came out in 2005. So that just that's a reissue that just came out, including a tacked on the end is three songs from me playing at Mumford Elementary School in Richmond's West End to a bunch of second graders. So that's like a nice little novelty at the end of it. That's called Laurel Street Demos. But my last full length is called 40 Miler, and I guess I'm feeling like it's been out long enough that in my head it's a little outdated, and I've been working on so many new songs that I'm sort of focused on that. But you asked about the title. The title 40 Miler is sort of a derogatory term. I've always been interested in freight train culture, the art on freight trains, riding freight trains illegally. And then anything that has to do with trains, for some reason, it's been a big part of my life for a long time. And because I ride trains, and I don't ride full-time, I'm not homeless, and I do it just to gain perspective and sort of leave the world that I live in. People like me are called weekend hobos for 40 milers by real rail riders, people who spend their life riding freight trains and going from town to town. So to parallel that and say, like, the music community, calling myself a 40 miler and titling my album 40 miler is almost like calling the new punk on the block a mall punk or a poser. So in a lot of ways, the album title is making fun of myself. The album cover art is very powerful and strong looking. But for those of you who know, it's actually like calling the album Tim Barry, you're a fucking poser. So that's the album title. But I guess I've been touring on the album for a while, and it's going to be a little different. When I toured the U.S. on it last year, I had most of the musicians who played on the record share the stage with me, and this time around, I'm going to attempt to do this with an acoustic guitar and just vocals. So we'll see how it goes.
So what prompted you to re-release those demos?
Well, the demos came out. The demos that were just reissued by Chunksaw Records are sort of like the accident that made this music public for me. I have always written songs on acoustic guitars, and you know, maybe recorded them on a primitive Tascam cassette tape recorder, and never done anything with them, but just hold them personally and never listen to them. And somewhere in the mid 2000s, I started going to Lance Kohler's studio down the street from my house in Oregon Hill, called Minimum Wage Studio, and just like demoing the songs, just having fun, like relaxing and recording them. And eventually I started sharing those recordings with family and friends. And those friends include road friends, people who I've traveled with, or, you know, people who are interested in music from like a lifestyle. And to be as short as possible about it, my buddy Oise, O-I-S-E, in Germany, had a small record label called Dancing in the Dark Records, and he talked me into releasing the songs that I had sent him as a demo only in Germany. And it kind of, like, I want to say took off, but it became interesting to me, the idea of trying to perform those songs live. So I went to Germany when the demo was released and started touring, and I sort of got addicted to the fright of, like, not having any idea of how to approach playing an acoustic guitar and sing in front of people. So I kept doing it and kept recording and kept putting out more records. Eventually that demo was re-released in the United States by Suburban Home Records, and eventually it went out of print on both record labels. So for a few years now, the Mumford live recording at the elementary school and the Laurel Street demos, which are my original recordings, have been unavailable. And just for the novelty of it, I thought it would be nice to keep them going digitally and physically on vinyl and CD. So Chunk's always willing to re-release them, and that just sort of completes, like, the archive of all of my music is available to anybody who's interested in it. And I can't say that I'm touring on that release because it just sort of popped up and happened in perfect timing for these dates. I actually wish I was smart enough to plan all that out, but I will not. So that's sort of, you know, I don't even know how much I'll focus on those songs live because I don't make set lists. I just kind of go with it. So I'm sure I'll bust out some of them songs, but they're not the greatest, but they certainly represent what I was doing at the time and, like, foreshadow what I was getting into in the future.
That recording at Mumford Elementary School, that's a fun record. I
agree. That's my only record that's ever been released that makes me smile. There's nothing better than hearing 22 second graders sing This Land Is Your Land with you at the top of their lungs.
Yeah, and you've kind of hit on it a little bit, but the transition from, you know, lead singer of a punk rock group to a solo, I don't know, folk artist, Americana artist, what do you call yourself?
I don't know either. I feel like I don't think much about my music as, like, a genre, as most people who play music. I don't think they think too hard on it, but I don't know what my approach is musically. I feel like it's just kind of just rock and roll music with an acoustic guitar, but because I grew up and continue to be a participant in, like, the counterculture, my approach comes from a kind of punk ethic where I am more abrasive than an Americana singer like, you know, Steve Earle. And I'm not as abrasive as sort of a grindcore basement band, so I don't know where I stand. It's just music, I suppose.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a transition that happened, as I mentioned before, by accident. Like, I grew up playing in the punk band Avail, and transferred to playing acoustic guitar and singing fairly quickly, and I think it was the conflict within myself of, like, pure fear that kept me interested in it. Not that I'll ever think I'll be able to conquer that fear, but I really embraced and continue to embrace the complete difference of having to depend only on yourself on stage as opposed to having your best childhood friends on stage, you know, all together, as Avail did nearly every night for most of our touring life. So with that said, like, I'm not sure that I plan on stopping playing this music anytime soon because I have more fun writing and recording than I ever have in my life. And still to this moment, I'm scared to death every day that I'm going to go on stage. I figure if I'm not scared to go on stage and I'm not happy when I get off, then I'll probably stop at that very moment and do something else. But right now I still feel that fear and I still feel that content and happiness when I finish, so I'm going to keep on trucking.
So you probably answered a question for me then. On 28th and Stonewall and on this album, 48 Miler, you have these songs that you know, express this extreme frustration with touring and being on the road, and you know, bus driver is kind of your "I quit" anthem. But obviously, you didn't quit. So, what is it that keeps you on the road? Is it what you just said?
I don't know what keeps me on the road. And it's the age old saying where, like, when you're home, you want to leave, and when you're gone, you want to go home. And I feel like I often feel a tremendous amount of anxiety before I'm about to leave for tour, mainly because I manage myself, and I do every single bit of work on my own. So there's a lot of work. There's a lot of back work that goes into it. And then I get on the road, and I feel like this overwhelming content, and I feel good. And then I start thinking about, well, I can't wait to get home. And then I get home, and I don't know what the big rush was. So it's this never-ending cycle that I've been going through my whole life. It's a love-hate affair with home and my road life. And at this point, it's just what I've done for so long that I think if I took either aspect away, I wouldn't feel complete. But I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's just what I do. And with all of that said, like, the songs that I've written in the last, you know, 10 years, I would have written and recorded anyway, whether anyone was going to listen to them or not. And I just feel lucky and thankful that some people enjoy the songs that I write, and I've had the opportunities to share them with people. Because, again, if I stop doing this today, I'm still going to write songs. I just won't put them out. And I'm thankful that I have that outlet. You mentioned, like, some frustration in the lyrics and, you know, about touring or whatever. I don't know if it's frustration as much as it is, like, just getting stuff off my chest. When I recorded my second record, well, my first real record, Rivanna Junction, my father called. He said, yeah, there's a lot of hurt on this record. Are you okay? I said, I'm just fine because I have that outlet. Like, I take those personal issues, put them in a musical format, and feel relieved, and then I can move on from them. And some people can relate to that, and it's nice that we have that outlet. So in a lot of ways, I write the way I write because it's easier for me to just get stuff off my chest in that way, as opposed to burdening my loved ones with the issues that I may have or may not have, because there is a lot of hope in my songs too, because I am a hopeful person and do think that if you treat people well, it makes life better for everyone.
Yeah, I definitely see that, definitely. And to that end too, I'm wondering, like, you said that the songs you write, you would have written anyway, and you write for, you know, expression, and but at the same time, when you write about, for example, social issues, or when you write about the song Prosperous Gabriel had an impact and seemed to mean a lot to some people, when you write a song like that, what are you thinking, or what is your...
Those are the songs that, like, there's a handful. It's hard for me to explain my writing process because I don't actively think, like, I have to write songs. A lot of people who write songs say this, and I'm just another one of them who says this, is that songs just show up often.
Yeah.
Some songs I'll sit with for months at a time until they make sense to me. Some songs just show up out of nowhere, and I don't know how. And many of those are the sort of storyteller songs that I've come up with, or the ones that are touching on specific issues. And three examples of songs that I barely recall writing but literally came to me very quickly would be Dog Bumped on Rivanna Junction, which is a story song.
Mm-hmm.
South Hill, which is a song about the human cost of war, and Prosperous Gabriel. I remember when those songs hit me in the head and where and what I was thinking about. I really don't remember writing them. Prosperous Gabriel, for example, I was walking near Belle Isle, but on the south bank of the James River one morning, and I was frustrated in the realization that the city of Richmond spends a lot of effort to honor Confederate quote-unquote heroes, but does very little to acknowledge and emphasize the efforts of people who were poor or enslaved. And that's a situation that happens in most cities everywhere in the world. And I remember being frustrated with the realization that the slave burial ground near 18th and Broad Street was a parking lot that had been shifted to students for Virginia Commonwealth University, and I was walking and I was frustrated. And years ago in the 90s, I had written a chorus in my head that didn't have lyrics, and it was and then I was walking, and does anyone know the name Gabriel Prosser? Stuck in my head because I was shocked by how few people I knew that actually knew who Gabriel was, who was an enslaved African who tried his best to rise up against the chains of the slave system in Richmond, Virginia, and free himself and other slaves from those shackles. And by the time I got home, I just hit play and record on my four-track and picked up the guitar, knowing clearly it was just a GCD song, and pretty much improvised an 8 to 9 minute version of the song. Went back and cut out the fat, which is crazy because the song's still about 5 minutes long, and sort of did a little bit of revisions and left it be, and that's where the song came from. I don't even recall writing it. It just showed up. Why that happens to some of us, I don't know. Why those songs impact people sometimes more than others, I don't know. I know there's plenty of people who don't want to listen to a five-minute history lesson, and that's one thing that's important about art, expression, music in any form, is that you can't have an ego. You have to understand that some people will like what you do and some won't. But that song, in the end, meant a lot to me because it helped in a small way rectify a situation that I abhorred and many other people abhorred. I'm not responsible for it, but there's no longer a parking lot over the slave burial ground at Broad and 18th Street, Broad and 15th, right in that area. But, you know, a lot of people put work into it. But I guess, you know, that song was another brick in the foundation of ridding our city from that embarrassment.
Yeah. It's pretty powerful song.
Yeah, it's pretty intense. I don't play it that much live anymore because it literally rips my heart out. So I was just in the UK. I might have played it 3 times. And it just, I leave the stage feeling shell-shocked every time I sing that song. It means that much to me. And I'm thankful that it showed up. And I'm thankful it was helpful.
Yeah. I saw your show when you opened for Asteroid Anthem here in Boston, and I know you're up there by yourself with your guitar listening to that song, and like you said, it's 5 minutes, but I don't know, people seemed okay with it.
Asteroid Anthem gave me a terrific platform to speak nightly about that issue, and it was very beneficial in the end to have the opportunity to sing that song in particular to so many people. It really put a lot of pressure on the city of Richmond. A lot of people wrote letters. A lot of people made sure that it wasn't just the people in the city of Richmond who acknowledged its wrongdoing by not representing the people who built the city that we live in a proper and respectful way. So I can't thank Asteroid Anthem enough for that.
When did you first, start writing songs? When did you first pick up a guitar?
Well, everybody, my family, everybody sort of like, there was always instruments around. I certainly remember the first song I wrote was a forlorn loss of my girlfriend who had gone on vacation to Georgia to see her dad. When you're 14 and your first love leaves for a week, it's the end of the world. And that's the first song I ever wrote on guitar and vocals. And I'm positive that's the first time I've ever admitted that. So I've been writing songs a really long time. Again, never with the intent of making them public. That's just became a part of my life later. But my mom recently retired, and she's back to playing the guitar again, too. And it's just it's just sort of a normal part of our family life. My brother lives in New York City now. He's a classical music composer. My sister lives across the river in Carver, and she's a violinist. She teaches violin, and she used to tour with me. So songwriting and playing music has really just been a normal part of my family life.
And your musical influences, what were they?
Say it again?
What were your musical influences?
Well, they started with whatever my parents listened to and was ever on the radio when I was a kid, so classic rock. And my mom always listened to tons of folk music, of course, Bob Dylan, Emmylou Harris, Arlo Guthrie, Woody Guthrie, Townsend Van Zandt, that kind of stuff. That was what was being played at the house. My father listened mostly exclusively to classical music, so that would probably be the reason for my brother being a classical music composer, a contemporary one. And then, of course, we all rebel. I hope we all rebel. So I left that world at a young age and got interested in thrash metal and punk and sort of stuck with that. And in the early 90s, I don't know what happened, but I started right back listening to folk music and a lot of country music. And that's the music I've always listened to. Maybe that's the music that I find the deepest connection with in writing and presenting live. But sort of, I know it's a played out term now, but the DIY community is how I learned to tour and how I learned to understand the business of music and the ethics of music. So I'm a weird mix of mainly interested in folk, country, and southern rock and stuff like that, but feel most kin to the way that punk and DIY has influenced like my decision making and how I do things.
Yeah, it's a this whole question of genres. I'm glad I never had to, run a music store and put music in bins, because it's not an easy thing to do.
It's a really weird world, and technology certainly makes it easier for all of us, but also a little more complicated. As far as people who play music, you kind of really have to be devoted to it, because you can't barely live off of it, financially. And that's why it's always important to have multiple trades, because you never know when you're going to come home from tour and need to find a job the next day. And that's something I've done nearly my whole life. I'll go through periods where I'll be touring so much that I'll be able to sustain, mainly because I'm on the road living off of per diems and whatever food you get at the shows and staying at people's houses. And sometimes I'm lucky enough to get home and not have to work. But it's just the cycle that we all go through. You have to really, really enjoy what you're doing. That's why I say as soon as it's not fun, I'm not going to do it. It's not worth it.
Yeah, especially these days, there's no textbook anymore.
Oh, and as much as I love things like Pandora and how many groups I've been turned on to listening to it, or I've still not used Spotify, but how eager people are to use that, it's like they don't pay us anything. So if that's the format that most people are getting music, it's a difficult one for us to sustain on, but at the same time, to flip it, it's like a painter wouldn't make a beautiful painting to hang on the wall backwards. He or she makes that so people can see it and find their own meaning in it. So why would any of us write songs that no one could listen to unless we are compensated for it? So it's nice that there's all these free or nearly free formats out there for all of us to share our music. And for us to complain about not getting compensated for it, it's actually just a waste of breath. It's just the changing times. You have to find ways around it, i.e. learning a fucking trade so you can work between tours, or nickel and diming, so you can, you know, sustain as long as you can on the little bit of money that you make on tours, because the royalties aren't there anymore.
Yeah, it's rough.
Right. Yeah, but it's rough, but it's like, again, what I'm saying, all that, it's not a complaint. It's just life. It's, you know, it's what it is. You know, you just do something else. So why bother complaining?
So I won't keep you much longer. Let me just run through. Oh, you said you talked about Process Gabriel, the song that just came to you. What is that your typical songwriting process? And then I read also that you for the 40 Miler, you said you threw out something like 25 songs. Do songs come to you easily? Do you spend a lot of time on them? What's your process?
I do spend a lot of time writing songs, but here's like the weirdness about me.
Mm-hmm.
I hear songs and sounds and colors. And so each song that I write has like a really strong color connected to it. And I write a lot of songs, and uh-huh. I throw out a lot of songs. And the songs that I keep and that I put on my albums are generally songs that have very strong colors. So when I say I throw out 25 songs, it really just means that the colors aren't popping at me. It just means that they haven't resonated strongly. And no harm, no foul. To me, maybe the songs aren't just aren't worth keeping. And I delete them, so I never hear them again.
No.
Much to my friend's dismay. So, yeah, I mean, even on this writing process where I'm, like, writing a lot right now, I've barely finished any songs. I probably have 30 ideas, and I don't know what that'll boil down to. I don't know when I record the next record whether it'll have 9 songs or 12 songs or, you know, 2 records with 30 songs. It just all depends on how it comes. I don't keep a process. I think life is just easier without, like, planning everything out and doing it like in the same way every time. If a song shows up, I work on it, and if I like it, I keep it, and it's that simple.
Yeah. It seems like you have just looking at your bio and the website and things, it seems like you have a lot going on, and so do you have like a set time every day or every week or whenever that you write, or do you fit it in when you can?
No, not at all. I don't think I do have a lot of stuff going on. And what I've had to teach myself to do is that when a song shows up, I just have to stop what I'm doing and work on it and be thankful that it showed up. Fairly difficult sometimes because I do juggle a lot of responsibilities. But one of my responsibilities to myself is how much I like making music. So I always have to set that time aside when a song does show up.